This is Central Time. A punishing winter storm this week knocked out multiple energy resources for the state of Texas. Millions lost power, hundreds of thousands still without power now, and many have been on boil water orders as well. The state's power grid is uncommon in the U.S. It's privatized, not under federal regulation, and it's cut off from other states' grids for the most part. We're going to take a look at what went wrong and what lessons we might be able to take away from Texas when we're looking at power in Wisconsin and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how our power grids work, the different energy sources, what it takes to manage an electrical system, especially in a crisis like this big, unusual snowstorm in Texas? Have you experienced a long-term power outage like what we're seeing in Texas? Are you listening to us from there right now or some of the other affected states? Love to hear your firsthand account. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lena Rold is an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering and a Granger Institute fellow in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. She works on modeling and optimizing energy systems as well as planning for uncertain events and large-scale outages. That's what we got here. Lena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello. Hey. And yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, Lena, online, I keep seeing people with a lot of really simple answers to what's going on in Texas. It looks like the story's a little more complicated than that. What stands out to you about what's gone wrong in Texas?
So I think what we can say is just that there are certain things here that are sort of predictable. You know, it's very cold, which means that we are going to have a really high demand for electricity and you know, natural gas for heating. But then on the other hand, what is very unusual is just how cold it is. And also how the cold has led to very widespread generation outages. So we've seen outages of nuclear power plants, of coal power plants, of natural gas power plants, of wind turbines. And so essentially there's this like one cause, the very cold weather that has, you know, spiked demand and at the same time reduced the access of generation. And so the question that really arises is, why did that happen? Why did so many generators sort of go offline and are not able to generate power? And so I think that is kind of the core question that we are sort of starting to see everyone try and answer, you know, like what went wrong? Why did we lose all this generation capacity?
Well, one question I've seen come up a lot is, okay, this, as you say, this bad a winter storm is an outlier, not common for Texas. How much, when you're designing an energy system, I guess, do you need to prepare for that outlier event, especially in this era of climate change where the last century's weather rules might not apply anymore?
Exactly. So I think that is really also cutting to the core of this problem, right? I mean, it's pretty predictable what you could do to prevent this. You could, you know, make sure that generators are better prepared for colder weather. You could take measures like that. You could, I mean, try and do things in the natural gas system in order to ensure that natural gas is more readily available, not only for heating, but also for gas generation, because that has been a major problem, is that the generators are not able to get enough gas, partially because of problems in the supply chain, but also because other people are using it for heating. And so it's kind of possible to fix technically, but it's going to be really expensive. And so as we're looking at this, this really falls into this bucket of low probability, high impact events. And it becomes this question of, you know, it's a low probability event that it should get so cold, but the impacts are so enormous. Does that mean that we have to plan for it? And if we have to plan for this kind of very low probability event, what other kind of low probability events should we be planning for? Like what steps do we take? And how do we use, you know, the resources that we have available in order to protect ourselves the best in the future? And these are really kind of open questions. And you know, like we need to be quite imaginative in thinking about for the future as climate change is going to evolve, what are the things that we are maybe going to see more of, and what are the things that we have not yet seen that we should be preparing for? So I think that is kind of some of the questions that arise in my mind when I'm looking at this.
We are talking about the energy situation in Texas, looking at the blackouts there, the winter weather, and the energy grid. Lena Rold is with us, assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about Texas and power grids with Lena Rold, assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. One culprit that's been pointed to by many Texas politicians, including the governor there, renewable energy sources, wind turbines and solar in the state. I want to give a listen to Governor Greg Abbott of Texas speaking with Fox News host Sean Hannity this week.
Sean, this shows how the Green New Deal would be a deadly deal for the United States of America. Texas is blessed with multiple sources of energy, such as natural gas and oil and nuclear, as well as solar and wind. But you saw from what Trace said, and that is our wind and our solar got shut down, and they were collectively more than 10% of our power grid. And that thrust Texas into a situation where it was lacking power in a statewide basis, that was power that was spread out by that ERCOT organization that you were talking about. As a result, it just shows that fossil fuel is necessary for the state of Texas, as well as other states, to make sure that we will be able to heat our homes in the wintertime and cool our homes in the summertime.
And Lena, this has been an argument we've seen spreading around a lot online. But as you were saying earlier, all sources of power pretty much were hit by the cold, including those fossil fuel sources the Texas governor was talking about, right?
Right. Yeah. So, and I think actually the Texas governor has been walking back some of his comments after that and also pointed out that, yes, that was also part of the problem, the other sources of energy. It's kind of indications that, you know, the natural gas generation capacity that was outage was substantially larger than the number of wind turbines that went out. This is really not a renewable energy problem. This is an extreme cold problem. And it's a problem of extreme cold where the power generation facilities have not been prepared and weatherized in order to be able to withstand this kind of weather. And that goes across all different kind of generation sources. So definitely not a renewable energy problem.
Let's bring on a caller. Mark is with us in Neenah. Mark, hello. Mark, are you there? I'm just hearing some background noise. Mark wanted to bring up the question of Texas, this unique situation where the grid is isolated in many ways from the rest of the country. Do you know what the reasoning is for that, Lena? And is that limiting the ability to borrow power, I guess, from other states?
Yes. So that is a very, very important part of this crisis as well in Texas and why Texas is getting hit so hard. And so Texas does have, there are three main power grids in the U.S. There is the Eastern Interconnect and there's the Western Interconnect, and then there is Texas. And so Texas is by far the smallest of those electric grids. And they have very small interconnection to the rest of the country. And so Texas has wanted to have energy independence and being able to regulate their energy industry quite independently. And that has, that gives them some freedoms that other states have not had. But in this situation, they really, when the whole area in Texas is suddenly facing this very cold temperatures, they are not able to rely on imports from adjacent areas like the other regions in the same way that other parts of the country would do. So, for example, here in Wisconsin, we are interconnected with all of the states around us. And if we have a problem with electricity generation here, we are able to get energy also from out of state. And so in that way, when you have larger areas that are interconnected, you are able to rely, provide much more mutual support in such extreme situations as what we are seeing right now.
Let's stay here in Wisconsin now. Obviously, I think it's safe to say we're pretty ready for cold weather. Our power stayed on through really cold weather over the last few weeks. What worries you in Wisconsin? What vulnerabilities should we be thinking about? What lessons might we still be taking from the past?
So what worries me in Wisconsin? Well, we are clearly good at cold weather. But still, I mean, we're also not immune to it. So this is something that we need to, you know, keep thinking about. I mean, just a couple of years ago, we had also a polar vortex where we saw like big temperature swings. And it is, of course, also the case that here that puts a lot of strain on the energy system. It is possible to, imagine situations where, maybe multiple possible sources of strain getting put on the grid at the same time. Like, for example, there is indications that if you have very prolonged cold scenarios, that could actually lead to, for example, lower availability of wind, which could, you know, reduce the available wind generation. And so there's definitely a need for us to really think about what those scenarios would look like in the future. Are we going to see, increased rainfalls? What is that going to mean for the grid? Are we going to see more droughts or higher temperatures? And so I think that we need to think out of the box in terms of historical scenarios and really get a little bit imaginative in terms of, you know, what is it that could happen here in Wisconsin? Because probably the people in Texas had not really foreseen or thought that they were going to find themselves in such cold weather. So we need to kind of open our eyes and think a little more widely about the possible scenarios that could happen in the future.
Now, in Texas, they have this this commission that keeps that's all over the news now. Who are the deciders in Wisconsin? Who is in charge of saying, okay, here are the possible threats to our grid and we need to take action?
So the system operator, the Midwest Independent System Operator, MISO, is the operator of the grid in Wisconsin. So they are the equivalent of there's a company called ERCOT in Texas who is playing a similar role. And so MISO is in charge of, they run a lot of scenarios and trying to understand and predict how in the future both the available generation is going to change and also the demand for electricity. So they are definitely also people who are in charge of assessing what we call resource adequacy in the grid. And then, of course, there's an important role here to play for regulators, both at the state level and also at the federal level, in order to make sure that that everyone puts rules in place in terms of, you know, making sure that power generation stations are ready for different kinds of weather scenarios. But sort of just to kind of get back to the system operators, which often have to do the work of trying to understand, you know, what are those scenarios and what are the implications of those scenarios, both on the grid, but also beyond the grid. You mentioned people having to boil their water, you know, many of the systems that we use day to day rely on electricity. These entities are also, you know, they have to rethink these days how they do planning. And that is both because they are seeing a lot more renewable energy on the grid, but also because the weather is changing and there is these kind of extreme scenarios that are coming out and that might become more frequent in the future. There's really a lot of work that is ongoing in that arena in terms of trying to understand better what scenarios to plan for and how to build, you know, an economically efficient safe and reliable grid.
Lena, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Lena Rold is an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering and a Granger Institute fellow in the UW-Madison College of Engineering. We talked to her about the problems that contributed to the massive power outages in Texas this week and lessons we can learn here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, COVID led people to buy lots of practical things, but there's been a lot of emotional spending, too. A Wisconsin personal finance writer tells us why our emotions can steer our spending decisions and how we can avoid big mistakes along the way. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, maybe these days you're bored, you're anxious, maybe you're tired of not seeing the sun, though there's some sun out right now. Whatever it might be, more people in a tough time are finding themselves doing what's called emotional spending during the pandemic. That can mean making purchases big or small that are made on impulse, maybe without a lot of thought, and maybe even later when they arrive or you bring them home, you feel like you might have made a mistake. We're all in different financial situations right now, but the easy access to stuff online can be real and can be a temptation for just about everyone. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found yourself doing more shopping online in the last year? And do you feel like your emotional state, whether it's Boredom, anxiety, stress has driven you to buy stuff on a whim or just to have a nice surprise arrive at your door later? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tell us about it over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Emily Guy Burkett is a personal finance blogger from Wauwatosa, author of several books, including End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, Emily, we've talked to you on the show before about our emotions and our money. Do you see a lot of this emotional spending happening during the pandemic?
Oh, absolutely. There's a number of things going on. There's kind of just garden variety boredom in the same way that people are probably snacking more during the pandemic as well. You know, if you're bored, it's really easy to navigate over to Amazon or, you know, your favorite retail site. And, you know, that's a way to kind of stimulate yourself in the same way that you may be raiding the cookies when you're feeling a little bored. Then there's also kind of a deeper issue called moral licensing. That's something, it's also called self-licensing. That's something where when you have given something up, you kind of give yourself permission to do something else to make up for what you gave up. So for instance, if you've ever had a salad for lunch and then thought, okay, I can have a hot fudge sundae after dinner. it's also why we tend to underestimate how far apart 6 feet is when we're masked with friends, because we're already giving one thing up in our brains. We're kind of like, oh, so I'm being good in this way, so I can be a little bad in that way. And so with everything that we have all given up collectively over this past year, it's a lot easier for our brains to be like, oh, well, you deserve a little pick-me-up, you know, like that cute mug or, you know, putting a down payment on a vacation in a year and a half or, you know, whatever the purchase is that feels like it's going to give you a lift. It's a way of kind of feeling like you're making up for all that you've given up through the pandemic. And that's very tough because we're all dealing with things that are just unseen by anyone who's currently alive.
Now, we heard from Denise on Facebook, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. She writes, I absolutely have been ordering more fun little things for the family. With 3 out of 4 of us home all day, every day, the days run together. It gets monotonous. A package showing up on the porch is a nice little pick-me-up, even if it's something I bought for myself. Now, that doesn't seem, Emily, too harmful to me. How do we draw the line between, yeah, this is a nice little strategy, a pick-me-up strategy, to I'm buying too much stuff and spending too much money?
So I really want to say if a little bit of shopping is going to help you feel a little happier, give you a pick me up during this very difficult time, go right ahead. You know, if this is not affecting your ability to buy groceries and keep a roof over your head and it's just a little something, and in fact, you're probably spending less elsewhere because you're not dining out or other things, go right ahead. There is nothing wrong with that. I mean, we are in an unprecedented situation. Where it starts to get pernicious is if you're spending money you can't afford. That's one thing. That's a very obvious one. But one that's a little less obvious is if you're saying to yourself, I deserve this. And I see the word deserve as being very dangerous. For one thing, because if you think that you deserve something, that means you could be undeserving of it. And that can be a very dangerous way of looking at things, because then you are doing that kind of self-licensing of like, oh, if I'm a good person, I deserve to have these things, but bad people are not deserving of these things. And that gets into a morality that doesn't need to be brought into this this issue. So if, you know, again, if you are intentionally planning on little pick-me-ups, that's great. And that can be a really good, mentally healthy way of dealing with this extraordinary situation. If you are thinking like, I've given up so much, I deserve to have a pick-me-up, that starts getting to be something that can be very mentally unhealthy and can lead to disordered financial behavior.
How do we check ourselves in that moment? Because especially for online shopping, it doesn't have to be premeditated. It's very easy to be impulsive. How do we, pull our hand off the mouse and interrogate our motives a little bit in that moment?
So there's two ways that I think it's really important to do that. There's the immediate way, which is you put the cookies up on a high shelf so that the kids can't get it. Sometimes you need to do the metaphorical version of that for yourself so that you can't make impulse purchases. So for instance, Amazon is very, very kind in remembering your credit card information for you. Well, you can turn that off. That is not for your convenience. And if you make it so that when you're about to make an impulse purchase, you actually have to get up and find your wallet and bring it over. And if you find yourself going, man, I don't want to do all that, that tells you, oh, I don't really want this purchase. So that's a very little thing that's kind of like the metaphorical version of putting the junk food in a place you can't easily get to. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is starting to think about what kind of habits-based person you want to be. There's a habit expert named James Clear who talks about building identity-based habits. So if you've identified a problem of like, I don't like that I'm making these impulse purchases, I want to be saving money more than I'm spending it or anything like that, then you can decide for yourself, I'm going to be the sort of person who saves money. I'm going to be the sort of person who waits 24 hours before making a purchase. And what's great about using that kind of phrasing is that you give yourself the chance to prove to yourself that that's the sort of person you are with every possible purchase in front of you. So, and even if you you do make an impulse purchase after you decide I'm going to be the sort of person who waits 24 hours, that doesn't mean you're not the sort of person who waits 24 hours. That just means you have another chance next time to wait 24 hours. And so it's a really great way of kind of reframing how you look at your purchases for a long term while hiding your credit card information from yourself is the short term solution that can really help.
Talking to Emily Guy Birkin, personal finance writer based in Wauwatosa, looking at the idea of emotional buying and how to avoid doing it, at least avoid doing it too much during the pandemic. You could join in if you have a story to share or a question or advice of your own. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Emily, that idea of replacing the habit that we don't like with something else, is there another way we can kind of reward ourselves for being good without having to spend money to do it? Can we? Because when I talk about to people about habits, like people who have quit smoking, a lot of the success comes from finding something else to do instead in those moments when you would have smoked. How can we replace that emotional buying habit?
So something that I think is really important is to kind of sit down and think through what's something small that you did in the past week or month that gave you an outsized level of enjoyment. So it might be that you took a bath or a nap, or it could be that you went for a walk outside. It could be that you sat and read with your kids, something small that was outside of the ordinary. And the thing that's really important about doing that is that you can start thinking like when you've got that like itchy feeling like I'm bored, I want to check out, sites that, often cause me to spend money. And it's not just retail sites. Places like Zillow and Pinterest can also cause spending binges. So when you start feeling that way, that like you're bored or you're sad or whatever it is, and you're looking for that pick-me-up, you can kind of think, oh, taking a bath feels really good too, and it doesn't cost any money. Or calling my sister and chatting for 15 minutes also feels really good and doesn't cost any money. And so it's that little thing that gives you that kind of outsized level of benefit based on what it is you put into it. And so making that intentional choice to do something that feels good that doesn't cost money can start making that the habit.
A big twist in all of this, Emily, I've heard trends over the years again and again that we were moving from buying stuff to buying experiences that we often find more fulfilling, whether it's a trip to the restaurant or a bar or a show or a vacation. Well, all those things are mostly just off the table right now. How much did this shake up the way we thought about how to spend money to enjoy our lives?
It does make things a lot more difficult. And to come back to what the listener was saying about getting those little packages is really exciting. Scientists have determined that spending money on experiences, you get more enjoyment, and it also small repeated experiences give you more enjoyment than one big experience. So meeting up with your best friends for a coffee once a week, every week for 6 weeks is going to be more enjoyable than going to a spa for 6 days with your best friend, because you get a chance to look forward to it over and over again and build off of it. And we can't do that now. We can't do either of those things now. And that makes it so difficult to kind of recreate those satisfying rituals that we had in our lives, those satisfying experiences. And oftentimes we'll then turn to shopping or purchases, because that is an experience. You know, you do have the experience of buying, the experience of receiving it, especially, you know, there's that kind of joy of like, oh, there's an Amazon package. What's in it this time? And there's nothing wrong with that. If you're working from intention, it's always important to make sure that you are making intentional choices with your money and not simply reactive choices, so that you can, again, make those intentional choices to kind of recreate whatever you can of those satisfying experiences while we're in this unusual situation.
This all takes me back, Emily, to a message I've heard from you before. We want to think we're rational people, especially when it comes to our money, but emotion is going to be part of the picture. Just being aware of those emotions and how they can affect us, that's a big part of the story, right?
Absolutely. So often all of this goes under the surface, and some of it just happens because much of our lives are under the surface. I mean, how many times have you found yourself, finishing a bag of chips that you don't remember opening? but some of it is also because money is such a taboo subject. We don't realize how emotional it is because we don't talk about it. And so having these emotional reactions to money and also using money as a solution to an emotional problem is very, very common when we are not talking about money, not feeling comfortable sharing money, successes or failures with others. And so we don't really know what to do or how to do things and kind of turn to this very, very imperfect tool over and over again in ways that can really harm our financial lives.
Emily, we'll leave it there. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Emily Guy Birkin, personal finance blogger from Wauwatosa, author of several books, including End Financial Stress Now, Immediate Steps You Can Take to Improve Your Financial Outlook. She joined us to talk about a rise in emotional spending during the pandemic. Still time for you to weigh in on the conversation, share your thoughts, maybe experiences on the Ideas Network Facebook page.